Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Cindy reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram for Tuesday, September 6th. Oil and gas production taxes top $10 billion. Controller, taxes to deposit $3.64 billion each in rainy day and state highway funds, by Mella McEwen. Economic benefits of the year's high oil and natural gas prices and rising oil field activity are being felt not just by the state's oil and gas producers, but by all Texans. Texas Comptroller Glenn Hager reported Friday that oil production taxes and natural gas production taxes collected by the state during its fiscal year 2022, which ended August 31st, surpassed $10 billion for the first time in history. Combined, the two taxes totaled $10.83 billion, 88% than the previous high set in 2014. Oil production taxes totaled $6.36 billion, up 84.4% from FY 2021 and $134 million higher than their revenue estimate. Natural gas production taxes totaled $4.47 billion, up 185% from the previous fiscal year and $9 million more than the revenue estimate. And Hager's announcement of tax collections data for the fiscal year, his agency reported it will be depositing within the next 90 days $3.64 billion each in the Economic Stabilization Fund, commonly known as the Rainy Day Fund, and the State Highway Fund. Both funds receive funding from oil and gas severance taxes. The upcoming deposit is more than $1.46 billion deposited in each fund last November. In a statement, Todd Staples, president of the Texas Oil and Gas Association, noted how the production taxes benefit all Texans. "It truly is astounding to realize that a deposit of $3.64 billion will be made in both the Economic Stabilization Fund and State Highway Fund," he said in the statement. "Highway improvement is fundamental to continued driver safety and economic growth. The ESF, or Rainy Day Fund, has been used to fund both public and higher education needs, retired teachers, and our state police, among many other essential services for Texans. It is good to know that oil and natural gas companies are using their recent success to fund more research and development, lower emissions technology, and add jobs for more Texans. We need to continue policies at both the state and federal level that unleash American energy leadership and ensure this production occurs here at home, so that we do not become dependent on foreign countries for our basic energy needs." Railroad Commission Chairman Wayne Christian said in a statement, "The oil and gas industry paid around $11 billion in production taxes alone last year, not including its strong sales tax contributions, directly benefiting Texans and our livelihoods, while wind and solar cost about $4 billion a year to state rate payers. Texas is blessed with a God-given abundance of oil and gas that reliably powers the world while also providing numerous monetary benefits to hardworking Texans." New culture leads to big change at Houston, by Stuart Doreen. Houston Collegiate Preparatory Academy celebrated its two complete years inside Midland ISD with a 36-point improvement in academic performance and a grade 1 point away from an A. Considering the campus score of 53 in 2019, there was a lot to celebrate. Houston Collegiate Prep officials credit a change of culture for the rapid turnaround and for the optimism heading into its third year. Houston Collegiate Prep is one of three Midland ISD schools turned over to an out-of-district operator. In its case, the operator is Third Future Schools, which is based in Colorado but has opened 3 schools in Texas, Midland, Odessa, and Austin. In 2020, Midland ISD announced the in-district partnership with Third Future as the school had 4 consecutive failing grades, 2016 through 2019, and was facing a potential takeover by the state. But Third Future came in, trained its staff on procedures for a turnaround campus, which meant a new hiring protocol. Before teachers get in front of kids, you initially have to perform in front of the administration so we can make sure that you're instructionally sound and you do know what you're talking about, said Principal Shamika Johnson, who is in her 6th year at Houston. The biggest turnaround is having the correct people with the correct knowledge in the right places, and then building up our leadership team as well, and everybody's talking the same language and moving in the right direction. Houston Collegiate Prep officials said the results have been the Texas Education Agency scores improvement, 1.6 years of average growth for students, and 12-point percentage growth on NWEA assessments. Another 2 or 3 years of that, and there is no achievement gap, said Zach Craddock, chief of schools at Third Future Schools. Craddock added that Houston's transformation from a failing campus to being 1 point away from an A, according to the Texas Education Agency, boils down to 3 factors: providing exceptional instructional feedback, exceptional leadership for the school, and building a positive culture that revolves around what's best for students, not adults. Not the typical elementary experience. Houston Collegiate Prep is a kindergarten through 6th grade experience for around 465 students. Those who attend the Central Midland campus, located adjacent to First Baptist Church, are set to receive the rigors of academic experience that is required of a turnaround school, but also benefits of an alternative educational setting. Craddock and Johnson talked about Third Future's DIAD program for students in 2nd grade and higher. According to the school's website, DIAD is based on the concept that learning comes from the acquisition of 3 things: knowledge, experience, and perspective. To help with the elective classes, Third Future brings in independent contractors to teach anything, including culinary arts, computer coding, agriculture, textile, soccer, karate, or aerobic exercise, like spin programs. Students earn credits, enjoy an alternative to PE, and can learn from a chef, sensei, or other community professionals hired by the school. The program allows older students to participate in programs with potential travel opportunities. In the past, Third Future Schools sponsored trips to places like Washington or even an out-of-country experience like Costa Rica. We think kids can learn anywhere, anytime, Craddock said. Small Town Sage plays out in real life on big screen. Joe Hawley, native Texan. Fort Davis. 4 young guys are sprawled in camp chairs on a 2-lane highway in what appears to be a treeless middle of nowhere. For some reason, one wears diving flippers on his feet. Traffic is not a problem. The friends are about to graduate high school. 4/5 of the senior class is a West Texas town called Dancer, population 81. On Monday, well, Monday is the day when the population shrinks to 77. At age 11, the boys had made a solemn pact to escape their little town as soon as they got that diploma. Early Monday morning, the hissing brakes of a bus and its big silver door, swinging open, will mark the beginning of their exciting new lives. Next stop, L.A. Maybe. In real life, L.A. came to Dancer, Fort Davis. 25 years ago, writer-director Tim McCanleys, a Texan himself, brought a film company to this small town in the Davis Mountains and stayed for 25 years. The result was a modest little movie about 4 young men facing a young person's existential dilemma. Should I stay or should I go? Dancer, Texas, population 81, got decent reviews and holds up pretty well today. On a recent Saturday evening, the Fort Davis Chamber of Commerce hosted a 25th anniversary showing of Dancer, with a potluck dinner duplicating a graduation feast in the movie. The plan was to screen the movie on the lush green lawn of the Jeff Davis County Courthouse, where the faux graduation ceremony was held. But the threat of rain prompted a change of plans. More than 100 moviegoers gathered under a covered pavilion, while kids and dogs ran around in the gathering dark. Only fireflies were lacking. Several locals who had walk-on roles came out to reconnect with their younger selves. "Did you rehearse your lines back then?" I asked Marianne Ludecki, a Jeff Davis County Justice of the Peace. "I did," she said, laughing, "all two of them." Having seen so many small towns that are withering away, Fort Davis is not one of them. I was curious about whether it's possible for young persons to stay. Do they even want to? "The movie came out when we were in high school," Chelsea Snyder told me. She grew up in Slayton, near Lubbock, but had driven over from Van Horn, the small town where she now lives. "It was the first film that depicted what we were going through," she said. Snyder's sister, Crystal Garcia, sat at the table with her husband Carlos and their two young adult daughters, Bailey and Emily. The Garcias, high school sweethearts, both went to Texas Tech, married and moved back to Slayton, population about 6,000. Their daughters hope to make Slayton their home as well. "It's not just a movie we're watching tonight," Crystal said. "It's a way of life." Reagan Stone, the young executive director of the Fort Davis Chamber of Commerce, grew up in San Antonio but spent summers with his grandmother in Falfurrias. He and his fiancée, Hannah Kate Schaefer, an artist and graphic designer, left Austin for small-town life in West Texas in March of this year. The slower pace and the quiet remind him of those Falfurrias summers, but cities have meant a lot to him as well. "I think my world and mind would be much smaller and for the worst," he says, had he not lived in Austin, San Antonio, and elsewhere. John Ludecki, husband of the JP, knows something about the peace and quiet and contentment of life beyond towns and cities. Like one of the boys in the movie, he grew up on a West Texas ranch. Except for his time at Sol Ross State University in nearby Alpine, he never left and has worked on a ranch for the past 47 years. "I hope to stay there until I croak," the lean, slow-talking cowboy told me. Marianne, tall and striking in boots, starched Wranglers and a western shirt, her silver hair flowing down her back from beneath a straw cowboy hat, is a bit more gregarious than her husband. The two met decades ago at Sol Ross, where he was teaching a science lab and she was one of his students. They have two grown children, both of whom left home after high school. Their daughter made her way back to the area, Texarkana-born husband in tow. Their son would like to come back. "The best thing a small town can do is let them go and let them find out about the big city," Marianne said. "You raise them up to turn them loose." "There's still a stigma about staying home," Crystal Garcia said. "Plus, jobs are hard to find." She and Carlos are able to live in Slayton because they both have good jobs in Lubbock. She with Aflac. He is the export sales manager for the Plains Cotton Cooperative Association. Grade and Hicks never expected to come home to Fort Davis. Superintendent of the Fort Davis ISD, he grew up on the historic Prude Ranch nearby, where, during the school year, his folks ran a school for kids with special needs. Summers, when the ranch became a camp, the Hicks family took 35 or so students on extended camping trips throughout the West and into Mexico. As a 10-year-old on one of those trips, Hicks saw the U.S. Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs and knew instantly what he wanted to do with his life. He might dip his wings to Fort Davis someday, but he wouldn't be living there. When he graduated from high school, his congressman rejected his Air Force Academy application but offered West Point instead. Hicks said yes and served as an Army officer for 20 years. He came back to West Texas in 2001 and was named the Fort Davis School Superintendent in 2005. These days, he worries about keeping a small school running in the face of declining enrollment and the state's Robin Hood requirements. Fort Davis, holding classes in buildings constructed in 1929, has no cafeteria, no band program, and no bus routes, among other deficiencies. Hicks is well aware that young families are likely to think twice about moving to a small town with a struggling school or no school. For Hicks, for most of the people I talked to in Fort Davis, the size of the town was less important than a sense of belonging, a connectedness they felt. Newlyweds Sensore Utsi, 27, and Marvin Stewart, 26, found that out when they pulled into a town they'd never heard of earlier this year. Growing up in Valley Stream, New York, on Long Island, they decided a couple of years ago that the crowded Northeast wasn't for them. They bought an 89 Ford Econoline van, installed a missing floorboard, and headed south and then west before settling in New Orleans for a few months. They played jazz on street corners, the van still their home. As it got hotter in the Big Easy, they decided to head to Houston. "Frankly, I was scared of Texas from what I'd heard," said Marvin, who's African-American. "But we kept meeting Texans on the road, and they were the nicest people." In Houston, he worked at an Aldine auto auction, but an ad for an internship of sorts at a winery near Fort Davis caught his eye. Heading west on Interstate 10, he and Sensore pulled into a town so small and peaceful, you could almost sit in a chair in the middle of the road. "Literally, within a week, the town just took us in," Marvin said. When the winery gig ended, the couple thought about heading to California, but their new friends wouldn't let them leave. Sensore was offered a job at the Jeff Davis County Library, Marvin at the Fort Davis Chamber of Commerce. They moved out of their vintage van into a real house their friends helped them locate. Although folks back home on Long Island don't quite know what to make of it, the new Texans are convinced they've found their dancer. "We were trying to find a community to be a part of it," Marvin told me. "We found it in Fort Davis."
News briefs. Odessa, man dies after wreck on I-20. A head-on collision on the North Service Road of I-20 resulted in the death of an Odessa man. Midland police reported Friday about 7:45 that officers and Midland Fire Department personnel responded to a two-vehicle collision in the 600 block of East Interstate 20. Upon arrival, investigators observed a 2021 Dodge Ram 1500 and a 2020 Nissan Rogue, both with significant front-end damage. The driver of the Nissan, Garrett Casey, was transported to the hospital by EMS, where he later passed away. Initial investigation determined that the vehicles collided head-on on the North Service Road. Next of kin has been notified. The investigation is ongoing. Lubbock woman dies in rollover north of Midland. A Lubbock woman died as a result of a crash Sunday north of Midland. Becky Lee Wilson was driving a 2017 Hyundai around 8:07 when the vehicle veered into the northbound lanes. DPS reported that she overcorrected, causing the vehicle to roll over. She died at the scene. She was wearing a seatbelt, according to the DPS. A 93-year-old man from Fort Stockton died this week after the truck he was driving ran off the road into a narrow ditch and then struck a fence. DPS reported Friday that Enrique Segovia Olivas was driving on the Market Road 1053 when it veered off the roadway into a rest barrow ditch. The automobile continued traveling in the west ditch where it struck a private fence before coming to a stop. The accident took place at 10:30 a.m. Monday, 8 miles north of Fort Stockton. Olivas was transported to Odessa Regional Hospital, where he died later that day. Passenger was not injured. One man died after a Mack truck collided with a Freightliner glider on Tuesday. DPS reported Friday the Freightliner with the trailer was traveling westbound on State Highway 302. in Reeves County when I crossed over the center and collided with a trailer that was traveling eastbound. After the collision, the Freightliner caught fire. Gary Keimer Ball died at the scene. The driver of the other vehicle, a 74-year-old man from Houston, was transported to Reeves County Hospital in stable condition. Texas Rangers are investigating an officer-involved shooting in central Midland. The shooting took place Friday at about 3 p.m. on Pine Avenue. No injuries were reported. The investigation is ongoing. An arrest warrant was issued in connection with the shooting that took place Thursday afternoon in southeast Midland. The police department reported Friday that officers reported to the 1500 block of East Illinois in reference to a gunshot victim. The victim was transported to the hospital. An arrest warrant for Jesse James Johnson, Jr. was issued in connection with the shooting. The investigation is ongoing. Oil tumbles amid growing economic worries. By Mel McEwen. Growing concerns that a global economic downturn will undercut oil demand sent oil prices tumbling as August turned into September. West Texas Intermediate rose 3 of 5 trading days, beginning with a 395 jump to 9701 Monday. But growing signs that oil demand could be under threat sent prices into free fall, with oil plunging $5.37 Tuesday, another $2 Wednesday, and another $3 Thursday. Prices eked out a 26-cent gain Friday to close the week at $86.87, down 6.5% from the week. The posted price ended the week at $83.35, according to Plains All American. Natural gas prices also wobbled during the trading week, beginning with a 29.5 cent drop Tuesday. Prices added 8.5 cents Wednesday and another 13.5 Thursday, but the week's gains were wiped out by Friday's 47.5 cent plunge. Henry Hub closed the week at 8.76 per MCF, down from 9.353. I continue to expect West Texas Intermediate to decline into the low 80s before finding the low for this cycle, Mickey Cargill told the Reporter-Telegram. The fundamental reasons for the recent decline are the Fed's resolve to stop inflation, causing concern of an economic slowdown, additional shutdowns in China, and high prices reducing demand. OPEC meets next week with the possibility of production cuts to maintain high prices. The price is dependent on OPEC's production levels. Ed Longenecker reminded that oil supplies will continue to determine price direction, and he sees several possibilities for supply constraints. We could experience further supply disruptions if the armed clashes in Baghdad continue and the OPEC Plus warning of production cuts to maintain higher prices could add additional pressure. Despite optimism among proponents of finalizing the Iran nuclear deal, we don't anticipate a resolution in the near term, nor would it have any material impact on supply. He added the backlash and optics for the Biden administration as the midterm elections approach could also be a motivating factor, given the likelihood of the nuclear deal resulting in stronger ties between Iran and Russia and its negative implications for the U.S. allies in the Middle East. That scenario doesn't bode well, given Russia's aggression in Ukraine and the weaponization of its energy supply over the past year, which alone could prolong negotiations, assuming a deal is reached at all. Another factor is that, despite its draconian COVID policies, demand will inevitably rebound in China, adding to an already undersupplied market. Thanks to our abundant supplies of domestic oil and natural gas, the U.S. is in a strong position to meet our growing energy needs and those of our allies abroad, which is especially relevant given the energy crisis that is unfolding in Europe, thanks to Russia and poorly conceived energy policies. All of this points to the importance of increasing domestic production, which will require investments in infrastructure and regulatory certainties. Seeing potential growth, maximizing returns. By Mella McEwen. There's a new company set to operate in the Permian Basin, born of the merger of Centennial Resource Development and Colgate Energy. Now known as Permian Resources Corp., the company is headquartered in Midland and plans to list its Class A common stock on NASDAQ under the ticket symbol PR. The stock will then transfer to the New York Stock Exchange around September. It's been a long evolution, observed Will Hickey, one of the co-founders of Colgate. Speaking by telephone with the reporter Telegram, he said Colgate had a good run of value creation over the last 6.5 years and was looking for ways to drive further value creation with an initial public offering among the options. He and James Walker, co-founder of Colgate, came to believe that combining Colgate and Centennial would maximize efforts to create value, bringing together two complementary, high-quality asset bases in the Delaware Basin. Hickey said headquartering the company in Midland was a key piece of the deal. Being here was important to us, given how long we've been in Midland and what Midland means to us. It creates a strategic competitive edge for us. It's close to the fields. Our team can get there in a quick drive. The deals and relationships with the service companies are all done on the ground here. The combination of Colgate and Centennial has turned Permian Resources into the largest pure-play Delaware Basin exploration and production company with deep inventory of high-quality drilling locations on about 180,000 net acres. Hickey said the new corporate name implies the company will remain focused with the Delaware. When he and Walter were forming Colgate, he said the Delaware was in its infancy. But now operators have cracked the code of the Delaware, driving down costs and increasing production. The Delaware has gone from what some hoped it could be to become the premium basin in the U.S., adding that he and Walter see more growth potential in the Delaware than in the Midland Basin. Currently, the company is operating an 8-rig drilling program and expects to go to a 7-rig program in November, delivering between 140,000 and 150,000 barrels of oil equivalent during the fourth quarter. For 2023, the company plans to continue a 7-rig program with the potential to reduce its rig count, assuming operational efficiencies. The rigs will spud around 145 wells, and the company will complete about 150 gross wells. Crude oil production growth is targeted at 10% in the fourth quarter of 2023 over the fourth quarter of 2022. During 2023, the company anticipates its operating activity to be split relatively evenly between New Mexico and Texas. The company will focus the majority of its New Mexico activity in the second and third Bone Spring sand intervals, while its Texas development will concentrate in the third Bone Spring sand and Wolfcamp intervals. Hickey said he and Walter will continue the model they put in place while developing Colgate, building the company around generating free cash flow and shareholder returns. Any growth needs to be founded with the goal of maximizing returns. The pandemic, he continued, taught the industry a lot about how to treat a balance sheet and how to run a low-cost operation. For the industry to be sustainable, he said it needs to maximize free cash flow and provide low-cost hydrocarbons. For Permian Resources, we want to be a major producer through investing free cash flow, returning cash to shareholders, and being good stewards of the environment. For example, Centennial has a large water recycling facility the company plans to retain, and the company will continue work to reduce flaring. He said the company will focus on ESG, environment, social, and governance initiatives to show the company plans to be in business for the long run. We want to be leaders in the field and in the community, he said. We're excited to grow our presence in Midland. Many of the Centennial people will be moving to Midland, and we're also looking to grow our presence in Midland through hiring. We're a fast-growing company. We have a great culture. We're looking to add to the team, and we're excited about our future as Permian Resources. PSP, State Understands Importance of the Permian, by Stuart Doreen. The state is understanding how important the Permian Basin is. That was one of the takeaways from the Permian Strategic Partnership of the announcement this week of $3 billion in Unified Transportation Program funding over the next 10 years for the Odessa District of the Texas Department of Transportation. We have their attention and their understanding how important the Permian is, said Tracy Bentley, executive director of the Permian Strategic Partnership, a coalition of 17 companies that seek to strengthen and improve the quality of life for Permian Basin residents by partnering with federal, state, and local leaders to develop and implement strategic plans that foster superior schools, safer roads, quality health care, affordable housing, and a trained workforce. The $3 billion for the Odessa District is part of the $85 billion 10-year transportation plan statewide that Governor Greg Abbott announced this week. The projects impacted in Midland County include around $600 million for three projects related to the improvement of Interstate 20, nearly $26 billion for the interchange at Loop 250 and Todd Road, and more than $11 million for intersections on State Highway 158 at County Road 120 and County Road 60 and Wadley Avenue. The improvements along I-20, which will include expanding the interstate to three lanes in each direction, is around one-third of the total money dedicated to the Odessa District in the UTP. The TxDOT reports that $1.24 billion will be spent on I-20 projects through 2032 in Midland, Ector, and Martin counties. Counties with projects funded in the Odessa District, according to UTP, include Andrews, Ector, Martin, Midland, Reeves, Upton, and Winkler. TxDOT also shows $218 million being allotted for multi-county projects. Bentley said the PSP has been advocating for road funding in the Permian, including working on a report to help justify the bigger spending. She said leaders like House Speaker Dale Phelan talked about the importance of the Permian Basin for the Texas economy during a recent address in the West Texas Legislative Summit. TxDOT Commission Chairman J. Bruce Bug has noted the importance of the region, which is home to one of the world's most significant oil patches. He calls it the Permian Promise. Texas Department of Transportation Permian Promise collaboration projects, according to the PSP, included the expansion of State Highway 349 from Midland to Rankin. The hope from the beginning was that our advocacy would mean just as much as the dollars that PSP companies are putting into projects across the West Texas and Southeast New Mexico. Every one of our board members would say we have exceeded those expectations. No one would have dreamed how effective those efforts could be. Bentley said that those lobbying for the PSP, including former Secretary of Commerce Don Evans, want lawmakers to address recapture during the upcoming session of the Texas Legislature. Midland ISD expects $153 million of the district's $437 million budget to be spent to be sent to Austin to be distributed to property poor districts across the state. This is close to do or die for MISD. If we don't figure out something soon, our district will be in harm's way. She also said that the PSP would like to see funds put toward workforce needs and health care. Having the state partner with us that is important. The PSP continues to work with the community and its leaders to find important and sustainable projects in education, transportation, health care, and workforce development. It's easy to appreciate the place that powers the U.S. A commentary by Ben Schaefer. Coming from central Pennsylvania to West Texas is a big change, but I've found lots of positives in Midland since I arrived about a month ago to start as a features reporter at the Reporter-Telegram. Aside from polite and hardworking people, I'm fascinated by the oil and energy industry that calls Midland and the Permian Basin home. When I first arrived in Midland after a three-day car trip from Pennsylvania in late July, my family and I took a drive around the city. When we drove past the oil fields on the outskirts of town, my father remarked, "It's amazing. This is literally the place that powers the U.S." As an outsider who comes from the East Coast, witnessing firsthand the land that powers the U.S. makes me feel like I'm behind the scenes of American vision and ability. In a feature story I wrote about Midland's Bolt Real Estate Group, there was a statistic from city officials that was included about Midland's growing population of young adults. Bolt isn't much different from Midland itself, whose residents boast an average age of 31 or 32, it read. An expanding collection of young adults and families moving to Midland more frequently in recent years shows me that the tall city is an area where people can grow, learn, and move forward in their professional and personal lives. This also says a lot about Midlanders of 20, 30, and 40 years of more who or more who are not afraid of fresh faces and new businesses. As a reporter, I've been treated with nothing but respect from those I've met, from business owners to political candidates and the common residents. As an East Coaster, being called sir is no short of a foreign concept. Before being hired at the Reporter-Telegram, I'd never been to Texas or anywhere near it. But based on my experiences thus far, Midland is as good a place as any to be introduced to the Lone Star State. Billy Linda Hairston Ingle passed away on August 4th. A memorial reception will be held September 10th at the Snyder Coliseum West Side from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. In lieu of flowers, the family wishes to remember Linda as you spend time with your loved ones. Danye Sade Blackwhite passed away. Visitation will be on Friday, September 2nd. Funeral service will be Saturday, September 3rd at Mount Rose Baptist Church, with interment following at Red Haven North Cemetery. Funeral arrangements are under the direction of Avila Sanchez Funeral Home. Evelyn Carnes passed away on September 1st. Viewing will be held from 8 to 5 p.m. Monday, September 5th at Nellie Pickle and Welch. Graveside service will be held at 11 a.m. Tuesday, September 6th at Rest Haven North Cemetery. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Jose Guadalupe Chavez passed away on August 30th. A viewing will be held from 8 to 9 p.m. Tuesday, September 6th and Wednesday, September 7th at Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. A rosary will be at 7 p.m. Wednesday, September 7th at the funeral home. Funeral Mass will be at 10 a.m. Thursday, September 8th at Our Lady of Guadalupe Catholic Church. Joshua Grant Berms passed away on August 31st. Graveside service will be at 1 p.m. Tuesday, September 6th at the Fort McKevitt Cemetery. Visitation will be at 5 to 7 p.m. Monday, September 5th at Kimball Funeral Home. Memorial services will be at 4 p.m. Saturday, September 10th at the Bulverde United Methodist Church in San Antonio. Arrangements are under the direction of Kimball Funeral Home. Linda Ewan Rodebush passed away on August 27th. A viewing will be held on Monday at 5 p.m. in the Weed Corley Fish Funeral Home on Park Crest. A funeral service will be held at Territon United Methodist Church on Tuesday, September 6th at 10 o'clock, with a reception following in the Fellowship Hall. Linda Harper passed away on August 30th. Visitation will be held Tuesday, September 6th from 4 to 6 p.m. at Pennington Funeral Home. Services will be Wednesday, September 7th at 10 a.m. at the funeral home. Funeral arrangements are under the direction of Pennington Funeral Home in San Marcos. Margaret Capron Jones passed away on August 24th. A memorial service will be held at a later date at First Baptist Church in Midland. Melissa Kendall passed away on August 29th. Visitation will be from 8 to 5 p.m. on Friday the 2nd at Nellie Pickle and Welch. The funeral celebration will be on Golf Course Road, Church of Christ, on Saturday, September 3rd at 10 a.m. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Risha Maureen Klimmer passed away on August 28th. No services are planned at this time.
Hello, this is Michael reading the first story from the front page of the Odessa American, Saturday, September 3rd. Legislators address big surplus. Landgraf and Sparks say robust revenues will cause extreme political jostling. By Bob Campbell. Awash in money, much of it from oil and natural gas taxes, after the strain of 2021's $5 billion in red ink, Texas lawmakers are looking to next year's legislative session with dollar signs in their eyes and Friday Night Lights competitiveness in their hearts. State Representative Brooks Landgraf of Odessa and Senator-elect Kevin Sparks of Midland say it will be tough to get the Permian Basin its share, but they're gearing up for the scrum when the 88th legislature convenes January 10th in Austin. The House of Representatives and Senate had $110.19 billion for general purpose spending for the current biennium, leaving the daunting deficit. But for the next 2 years, they will have $149 billion and a $27 billion surplus, according to State Comptroller Glenn Hegar. Landgraf said 51% of the revenues are from sales taxes, 8.4% from oil production taxes, 6% from natural gas, 7.6% from motor vehicle sales and rentals, 5% from franchise taxes, 1.3% from motor fuel taxes, 9% from other state levies, and 11.8% from fees and other non-tax sources. The Republican chairman of the House Environmental Regulation Committee said Wednesday that oil taxes will boom by 90% and generate $12.81 billion compared to $6.6 billion. Natural gas money will balloon by 266% and amount to $9.15 billion compared to $2.49 billion, he said. You see the hands start to come out when the comptroller makes his revenues estimate public, and everybody knows how much is in the state coffers, Landgraf said. The basin has been allocated a record-breaking $3 billion over the next 10 years in the Texas Department of Transportation's Unified Transportation Plan. But as everyone who lives in West Texas knows, we have plenty of needs in our highway infrastructure. I've gotten to be real close with all the transportation commissioners and have let them know what a dire situation we have in terms of fatal accidents. Just because we don't have big city freeways out here doesn't mean we don't have real transportation needs. The attorney said citizens must have ample health care opportunities and that superintendents in the six school districts he will represent in the redrawn 81st district want to make sure their schools are properly funded. We are also overdue for broadband infrastructure in West Texas, he said. After January 1st, Landgraf will represent 194,303 people in Winkler, Ward, Loving, and Ector counties, having lost Andrews County in statewide redistricting to House District 88, which is represented by Canadian Republican Ken King. I don't care if it's oil and gas severance tax revenues here or sales taxes at Neiman Marcus in Dallas. I'll be fighting with our West Texas delegation to make sure we get our fair share of state resources, he said. Noting that the legislature gave $9 billion to public schools in 2019 and the same amount 2 years later, Landgraf said the superintendents are saying we need to make that commitment again, and I'm confident that we will be able to do that.
This is Jane reading for the OA for Saturday, September 3rd. From the local news roundup, indicted man arrested for failing to get GPS monitor. A 33-year-old Odessa man indicted 19 months ago on an aggravated sexual assault charge was arrested Thursday afternoon. According to Ector County District Court records, Manuel Olivas is accused of raping a woman at knife point in the January 2021 and was indicted the following month. In June 2021, Ector County's Pretrial Services Office informed Judge Justin Lowe of the 161st District Court Olivas failed to show up to get his GPS monitor, and a warrant was issued for his arrest, court documents show. Olivas remained in the Ector County Jail as of Friday morning with a $60,000 surety bond. Man arrested after failing to report to bail bond company. A 28-year-old Odessa man accused of threatening a woman with a sword after coming into her house uninvited in January is back in jail. According to Ector County District Court records, Jontel QB Mack was indicted in April on aggravated assault with a deadly weapon and burglary charges and released from jail after posting $65,000 in surety bonds. On Thursday, the bail bond company asked Ector County District Court Judge James Rush to issue a warrant for Mack's arrest, stating he had failed to report in with them and wasn't returning their phone calls, court records show. Mack was booked into the Ector County Jail around 7 p.m. on Thursday. Online jail records show Mack was also arrested on two warrants one alleging he violated bonds or a protective order two times or more within a 12-month period, and one alleging he evaded arrest or detention. DPS reports death in separate wrecks. Three people have lost their lives in separate accidents in the Permian Basin in recent days. According to the Texas Department of Public Safety, Lubbock resident Becky Lee Wilson, 53, was traveling south on State Highway 349 when her Hyundai Tucson veered into the northbound lane around 11 a.m. on Sunday, causing her to overcorrect and the vehicle to roll. Wilson, who was wearing a seatbelt, was pronounced dead at the scene of the crash, which took place 6 miles north of Midland. On Monday morning, Enrique Segovia Olivas, 93, of Fort Stockton, was killed when his Chevrolet Silverado veered off southbound FM 1053, 8 miles north of Fort Stockton. The Chevy went into a west barrow ditch and then hit a fence before stopping, according to DPS. Olivas, who was wearing a seatbelt, was taken to Odessa Regional Hospital, where he was pronounced dead. His 66-year-old passenger, another Fort Stockton resident, was uninjured. On Tuesday, Gary Kemer Ball, a 56-year-old Cedar Bluff, Virginia resident, was killed around 5:30 a.m. in Reeves County, according to the DPS. Ball was traveling west on South Highway 302 in a Freightliner glider with trailer when the vehicle crossed the center line near mile marker 186 and collided with a Mack truck going east and caught fire, according to the DPS. Ball was pronounced dead at the scene, and the driver of the Mack truck, a 74-year-old man from Houston, was taken to Reeves County Hospital in stable condition. Rangers investigating officer-involved shooting. The Texas Rangers are investigating an officer-involved shooting that took place around 3 a.m. on Friday on Pine Street. Martha Cortazar, a communications coordinator with the City of Midland, said the investigation is ongoing and she did not know who was shot, an officer or someone else. Nor did she know their condition. The Rangers are asked to investigate all shootings involving MPD officers. Odessa man dies in wreck. At about 7:45 a.m. on Friday, the Midland Police Department and Midland Fire Departments responded to a two-vehicle collision in the 600 block of East Interstate 20. Upon arrival, investigators observed a 2021 Ram 1500 and a 2020 Nissan Rogue, both with significant front-end damage. The driver of the Nissan Rogue, Garrett Casey of Odessa, was transported to the hospital by EMS, where he later passed away due to his injuries. Initial investigation determined that the vehicles collided head-on on the North Service Road of Interstate 20. Next of kin has been notified, and the investigation is ongoing.
From the inside pages of the OA Saturday. Former Fort Stockton educator and coach arrested for improper educator-student relationship. On June 20th, El Paso Sheriff's Office deputies were dispatched to a residence in Fabens in reference to information on an improper relationship between an educator and student, a post from the EPSO Facebook detailed. During the preliminary investigation, deputies received information that a coach employed with the Fabens Independent School District was sending inappropriate text messages to a student, according to the sheriff's office website. At the time, the investigation was turned over to the Major Crimes Unit. During the course of the investigation, detectives obtained information that the coach and student had sexual intercourse inside a locker room at Fabens High School, located at 601 Northeast G on June 16th, the site said. The coach was identified as 27-year-old Cale James Danielson. Danielson was no longer employed with Fabens ISD when the investigation was conducted and was no longer living in El Paso County. A warrant of arrest was issued for Danielson for improper relationship between educator and student with a $50,000 bond. Danielson turned himself in on August 17th at the El Paso County Detention Facility. Danielson posted bond that same day and is no longer in custody. The Fort Stockton Pioneer newspaper reported in June that Danielson had been hired at the school district as a middle school teacher, PE coach. But a news report said he was no longer working at Fort Stockton ISD. Fort Stockton Superintendent Gabriel Zamosa issued the following statement. The safety of our students is a top priority at Fort Stockton ISD. The student would never knowingly place our students or our staff in harm's way. Our human resources specialists conduct background investigations, review SBEC certifications, among other safety precautions, of prospective and current employees. Upon being made aware of criminal allegations against a new hire previously employed at a district in El Paso County, immediate action was taken to ensure the safety of our students. The actions taken were of a precautionary measure and should not be construed as an implication of guilt over matters that did not take place within our district's boundaries. FSISD will continue to work with our school attorneys to pursue the correct course of action for all parties involved.
This is Jane reading for the OA for Saturday, September 3rd, from the obituary and death notice section. Michael Scott Fryer, 58, of Midland, entered eternal rest on August 23rd. He passed peacefully in his sleep with a smile on his face and was welcomed in the arms of Jesus. He was born to Jean and Betty Fryer on August 24th, 1963, in Odessa, and was the only boy after having three older sisters. He is preceded in death by his parents, Jean and Betty Fryer. Left behind to cherish the precious memories are his three loving sisters, Becky, Kathy, and Debbie. Cremation by Yellow Rose Crematorium will be followed by a private family celebration of life. Frankie Joe Martinez Rodriguez was born November 11, 1962, and raised in Odessa. He went to be with his God on Monday, August 29th. He is survived by his son, Stephen Rodriguez, and big brothers, Herminio Rivera, Pedro Rodriguez Jr., and preceded in death by Pedro L. Rodriguez, Aurora Rodriguez, Mary Rivera, Antonio Rivera Sr., and Johnny Mendoza. Memorial services to be held on Tuesday, Saturday, September 3rd, in the chapel of Odessa Funeral Home, with a rosary being recited at 1 p.m., Interment will take place at Ector County Cemetery at 9 a.m. on Tuesday, September 6th. Deborah Jean Minchie, 63, passed away at Medical Center Hospital in Odessa on Friday, August 26th. She was born in Hobbs on Thursday, March 12th, 1959, to the late Gwen and W.L. P.A. Castleberry. Those left to cherish her love and memory are her son, Shane Minchie, and his wife Lavenda of Andrews, his siblings Daryl Castleberry and Donna Hazard. Arrangements are entrusted to Acres West Funeral Chapel, and condolences may be sent to the family online at acreswestfuneral.com. Jose Guadalupe Chavez, 66, of Midland, passed away at his home on Tuesday, August 30th. A viewing will be held from 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. Tuesday, September 6th, and Wednesday, September 7th, at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home Chapel. A rosary will be recited at 7 p.m. Wednesday, September 7th, at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home Chapel. Funeral Mass will be held at 10 a.m. on Thursday, September 8th, at Our Lady of Guadalupe Catholic Church. The family has requested that he be cremated. Lupe is survived by his daughter, Catalina Chavez Terrell, his son, Alex Emmanuel Chavez, and his grandson, Sebastian Alex Chavez Terrell. Lupe is preceded in death by his wife, Maria del Refugio Esquivel, and daughter, Catalina Chavez. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at npwelch.com. Leonardo Bustos, 92, of Odessa, died on Thursday, September 22nd. Funeral service will be held at 1 p.m. September 8th, St. Joseph's Catholic Church. Burial will be followed at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Father Chavez is officiating. Arrangements are by Sunset Memorial Garden and Funeral Home of Odessa. In Candelia, Texas, Joshua Grant Burmese, 47, passed from this life on August 31st at his residence. Josh was born July 28, 1975, to George and Janet Burmese in Odessa. Josh is preceded in death by his grandparents, Davis and Eula Murr, and grandmother, Connie Burmese. Those left to honor his memory include his parents, George and Janet Burmese, his daughter, Daisy Grace Burmese, his son, Bronson Lane Burmese, and their mother, Michelle Burmese, his brother, Justin. Graveside services will be held at 1 p.m. Tuesday, September 6th, at the Fort McCavitt Cemetery, with the Reverend Dr. Ralph Mann officiating. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. Monday, September 5th, at Kimball Funeral Home. Memorial service will be held at 4 p.m. on Saturday, September 10th, at the Boulevardi United Methodist Church at 28300 U.S. 281 in San Antonio. Arrangements are under the direction and personal care of the professionals at Kimball Funeral Home. Gary and Dennis Brunson, 73, of Odessa, passed away on Sunday, August 28th. Memorial services will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday, September 2nd, at Crossroads Church, with Reverend David Newton officiating. Gary was born in Dallas to Roland and Helen Brunson on March 24, 1949. Gary was preceded in death by his father, Roland Bryant Brunson, his mother, Helen Shelton Brunson Crow, his stepfather, George Edward Crow, and his sister, Thelnita Brunson Fincher. Gary is survived by his wife, Lori Kelly Brunson, and his sons, Jeffrey, Joey, Lenny, and Joshua, and his daughters, Joylyn Brunson and Cherie Lenny. Memorials may be given to Texas Lions Club Camp in Kerrville. Gary and Lori's family look forward to visiting and sharing memories with you, his treasured friends, over the next few months. Arrangements are entrusted to Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home. To send condolences to the family, please sign his guest book at sunsetodessa.com. Danny Randolph Black, age 66, passed from this life at Medical Center Hospital on Friday, August 26th, after a long battle with prostate cancer. He was born Saturday, January 28, 1956, in Odessa, to the late John Randolph and Oma Nadine Black. Those left to cherish his love and memory include his daughter, Danielle Denise, his sister, Patricia Nadine Castle. Danny was preceded in death by his parents and his sister and brother-in-law, Elaine and Steve Joy. Funeral services to celebrate Danny's life were held at Acres West Funeral on Thursday, September 1st at 2 p.m. Pastor Clyde L. Chapman was the officiant. Arrangements are entrusted to Acres West, and condolences may be sent to the family online at acreswestfuneral.com. Flowers are welcome, and in lieu of flowers, please send a donation to a charity of your choice in honor of Danny Randolph Black.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.